He had a stop to make before heading out toward the beach. The two garage doors were open at Zocalo Auto Services when she got there. She had driven her van because she was not planning to go back to the station afterward. A man stood in one of the open bays, wiping his already greasy hands on a rag and assessing the Ford Transit with the board racks. Ballard got out and quickly showed her badge to disabuse him of the idea that she was a potential client. "Is the owner or manager here?" she asked.
"That's me," the man said. "Both? Ephraim Zocalo."
He had a strong accent. "Detective Ballard, LAPD Hollywood Division. I need your help, sir."
"What can I do?"
"I'm trying to confirm that a particular van was here getting work done. A transmission, possibly, 9 years ago. Is that possible? Do you have records from 09?
"Yes, we have records. But that is a very long time ago."
"You have computer records? Maybe just put in the name?"
"No, no computers. We have files and we keep, you know, we keep the papers."
It didn't sound too sophisticated, but all Ballard cared about was that there were records of some sort. "Are they here?" she asked. "Can I look? I have the name and dates."
"Yeah, sure. We have in the back."
He led her to a small office adjacent to the repair bays. They passed a man who was working in a trench beneath a car, the high-pitched whine of a drill sounding as he removed the bolts of a transmission cover. He looked suspiciously at Ballard as she followed Zocalo to the office. The office was barely big enough to hold a desk, chair, and 3 4-drawer file cabinets. Each drawer had a framed card holder on which a year was handwritten. This meant Zocalo had records going back 12 years, which gave Ballard hope.
"You said 09? Zocalo asked.
"Yes," Ballard said. He pointed a finger up and down the drawers until he found the one marked 2009. The labels were not in a clear chronological order, and Ballard guessed that each year he dumped the oldest set of records and started with a fresh drawer. The 2009 drawer was the second drawer up in the middle row. Zocalo waved at it with an open hand, as if saying it was all Ballard's to deal with. "I'll keep everything in order," she said.
"Don't matter," Zocalo said. "You can use the desk."
He left her there and went back out into the garage. Ballard heard him saying something in Spanish to the other worker, but they spoke too fast for her to translate the conversation. But she heard the word migra, and her sense was that the man in the garage trench was worried that she was really an immigration agent. She pulled the file drawer open and found it to be only a third full of receipts, leaning haphazardly against the back panel. She reached down with both hands, pulled about half of them out, and carried them to the desk. All surfaces of the desk seemed to be coated with a patina of grease. Zocalo clearly didn't visit the sink when he moved from doing repair work to office work. Many of the invoice copies she started looking through were also smudged with grease. The invoices were generally kept in order by date, so the process of checking the alibi for John the Baptist's van went quickly. Ballard moved through the stack directly to the week in question and soon found a copy of an invoice for installation of a new transmission in a Ford Econoline van with the name John McMullen and the address of the Moonlight Mission on it. Ballard studied it and saw that the dates the van was in the shop corresponded with the blank squares on McMullen's calendar and covered the 2 days that Daisy Clayton was missing and then found dead. Ballard looked around the office. She saw no copier. Leaving the McMullen receipt out, she returned the rest of the stack to the file drawer and closed it. She walked out of the office and into the garage. Zocalo was down in the trench with the other man. She squatted down next to the car they were working under and held out the grease-smudged invoice. "Mr. Zocalo, this is what I was looking for. Can I take it and make a copy? I'll bring you back the original if you need it." Zocalo shook his head.
"I don't really need to have it," he said. "Not for so long, you know. You just keep it. It's okay."
You sure?
Si, I'm sure.
Okay. Thank you, sir. Here's my card. If you ever need my help with anything, you give me a call, okay?
She handed a business card down into the trench, and right away it was marked with a greasy thumbprint as Zocalo took it. Ballard left the garage and stood next to her van. She pulled her phone and took a photo of the invoice Zocalo had let her keep. She then texted the photo to Bosch with a message. Confirmed. JTB's van was in the shop when Daisy was taken. He's clear. Bosch didn't respond right away. Ballard got in her van and headed toward Venice. She caught the morning migration west, and it took almost an hour to get to the overnight pet care facility where she kept Lola. After she got her dog and took her for a short walk around the Abbot Kinney neighborhood, she returned to the van and drove over to the canals, Lola sitting upright on the passenger seat. Public parking near the canals was at a premium. Ballard did what she often did when she visited Aaron. She parked in the city lot on Venice Boulevard and then walked into the canal neighborhood on Dell. Aaron shared one side of a townhouse duplex on Howland with another lifeguard. The other side of the duplex was also the home of lifeguards. There seemed to be a steady rotation of them moving in and out as assignments changed. Aaron had been there for 2 years and liked working Venice Beach. While others aspired to assignments farther north toward Malibu, he was content to stay and therefore had the longest residency in the duplex, which was notable for its dolphin-shaped mailbox. Ballard knew that Aaron would be home alone, since all lifeguards worked day shifts. She patted the dolphin on the head and led Lola through the gate by her leash. The sliding door on the lower level had been left half open for her, and she entered without knocking. Aaron was lying on the couch, eyes closed, balancing a bottle of tequila on his chest. He startled when Lola went over and licked his face. He grabbed the bottle before it fell. "You okay?" Ballard asked.
"I am now," he said.
He sat up and smiled, happy to see her. He held out the tequila, but she shook her head.
"Let's go upstairs," he said.
Ballard knew what he was feeling. Any death experience, whether it was a close call for oneself or involvement in the death of another, led to some kind of primordial need to affirm not having been vanquished from existence. That affirmation could turn into some of the best sex ever. She pointed Lola to a dog bed in the corner. Aaron had a pit bull, but he had apparently taken her to the kennel, even though he had the day off. Lola dutifully climbed onto the round cushion, circled it 3 times, and finally sat down with a view of the sliding door. She would be on guard. There was no need to even close the slider. Ballard went over to the couch, grabbed Aaron's hand, and led him toward the stairs. He started to speak as they went up.
"They took him off life support at 9 last night, after they got all the family there. I went over. I sort of wish I hadn't. Not a good scene. At least they didn't blame me. I got to him as fast as I could."
Ballard quieted him when they got to the bedroom door. "No more," she said. "Leave that out here." 30 minutes later, they were lying entwined and spent on the floor of Hayes's bedroom.
"How'd we get off the bed?" Ballard asked.
"Not sure," Hayes said.
He reached over to the tequila bottle on the wood floor, but Ballard used her foot to push it out of reach. She wanted him to hear what she said next.
"Hey,"
Hayes said, feigning upset.
"Did I ever tell you that my father drowned?" Ballard asked. "When I was a kid."
"No, that's awful."
He moved in closer to her to console her. She was turned and looking at the wall.
"Did it happen here?"
Hayes asked.
"No. Hawaii," Ballard said.
"That's where we lived.
He was surfing.
They never found him."
"I'm sorry, Renee.
It was a long time ago. I always just wished they had found him, you know? It was so strange that he just got on his board and went out there, and then he never came back."
They were silent for a long moment. Anyway, I was thinking about that with that guy yesterday, Ballard said. At least you brought him in. Hayes nodded.
That must have been awful for you back then, he said. You should have told me this before.
Why?
I don't know. It's just sort of, you know, your father drowns at the beach, and now you mostly sleep at the beach. You and me, with me being a lifeguard. What's that say?
I don't know. I don't think about it.
Did your mother remarry?
No, she wasn't around.
I don't think she knew for a long time. Oh, man, this story just gets worse.
He had his arm around her, just below her breasts. He pulled her against his chest and kissed the back of her neck. I don't think I'd be here doing what I do if things hadn't happened the way they did, Ballard said. There's that. She reached her leg out, hooked the tequila bottle, and slid it in so he could reach it. But he didn't. He kept her in his embrace. She liked that.
Bosch. Chapter 23. Bosch waited for Lourdes in the Starbucks a block from the station. He sat at a tall bar table that allowed him to keep his left leg straight. He had just come from Dr. Zhang's, and the knee was feeling good for the first time in 2 weeks. He knew that bending the joint might cut that relief short. That was inevitable with walking, but for now he kept it straight. He had gotten Lourdes a latte and himself a straight black. They had agreed to meet away from the station after she did some preliminary intelligence gathering while he was getting needles stuck in his leg. Lourdes arrived before the latte got cold. How's the knee? She asked. Feeling pretty good at the moment, Bosch said. It won't last. It never does. Have you ever gotten a cortisone shot? No, but I'm ready to try anything but a knee replacement. Sorry, Harry. Nothing to be sorry about. What did you find out? The night before, LAPD SWAT had moved in on the house Bosch and Lourdes had located in Sylmar and arrested 4 men, all Sanford's gang members, and including one man who was found in a bed, suffering from a gunshot wound to the stomach. He was 38-year-old Carlos Mejia, and he was the suspected shooter of Martin Perez. The other 3 were low-level gangsters, most likely assigned to watch over Mejia and bring the doctor to him. All 4 were arrested on various gun and drug charges, as well as probation violations. Mejia was not charged yet with the Perez killing, because the evidence was only circumstantial at the moment. He had been shot, and it was believed that Perez's killer had been shot. The upward trajectory of the wound trail through Mejia's lower intestine fit with the ricochet in the shower theory as well, but it wasn't enough to take to the district attorney's office. The bullet had been removed from Mejia's gut and disposed of. There would be no ballistics match to the bullet taken from Perez's brain. However, the forensic team that processed the Perez crime scene had found that the blood spattered in the shower stall had come from 2 individuals, Perez and presumably his shooter after he caught the bouncing bullet. Confidence was high that a DNA comparison between Mejia's blood and that found in the shower would lead to a match, and Mejia would be charged with murder. He was now in the hospital ward of the county jail while a rush was put on the DNA comparison. The intel gathering that Lourdes had undertaken that morning was related to Mejia and any connections he might have with those who knew about the renewed investigation of the Uncle Murda case and that Martin Perez had flipped. I really hate this, Lourdes said. What if we're wrong? We make sure we aren't, Bosch said. What did you find out? She opened a small notebook she always carried with her. Okay, she said, reading her notes. I talked to my cousin and a couple other guys in gang intel. They say Mejia is the Sanford OG known as El Brujo. What's that? Sorcerer? More like witch doctor, but it doesn't matter. He got the moniker because of his ability to find and get to people who supposedly can't be gotten to. Case in point, Perez. Somebody told him. I'm getting to that. The intel guy said that Mejia pretty much had his own set in the gang and would have been on equal footing with Tranquilo Cortez. So you can see how this is all cinching up. El Brujo hears somehow that Perez flipped and decides to take care of it for Cortez. End result, Cortez owes Mejia. Got it. The question is, how did he hear that Perez was flipping? Lourdes nodded and a painful frown creased her face again. What is it? Bosch asked. Well, she said, when the intel guys were talking to me, one of them says maybe you should talk to your buddy Oscar about El Brujo. He grew up with him. I said Oscar Luzon to confirm, and they said, yeah, Luzon. They said Oscar and Mejia went all the way back to Gridley. Bosch knew that Gridley was an elementary school on 8th Street. So was this connection in the gang book? Bosch asked. Because of the unavoidable connections between some homegrown SFPD officers and local gangs, the department had a registry, known as the gang book, in which officers named acquaintances in the gangs. It allowed the officers to avoid suspicion should the connections become known through the course of investigations, wiretaps, and street gossip. The book was also a resource for gang intel officers when they wanted to target a particular gang member. If there was a connection in the book, it could be exploited by using the officer to initiate communication with the gang member or even cross paths with him in a seemingly coincidental way. No, they said Luzon never put it in the book, Lourdes said. They only know because they have class photos from all the schools in the city going back to the 70s. They have photos of Luzon and Mejia in the same classes at Gridley and then Lakeview. But a few years ago, when they asked Oscar why he never put it in the book, he said it was because he didn't really know Mejia. Did they believe him? Bosch asked. Well, they accepted it. The question is, do we believe it? The same class through elementary and high school, and Luzon says they didn't know each other? No, I don't believe it. Lourdes nodded. She didn't believe it either. So how do we do this? She asked. We need to talk to him, Bosch said. I know that, but how? Does he still take his gun off when he works at his desk? I think so. They needed to separate Luzon from his weapon before they confronted him. They didn't want to risk his harming them or himself. Luzon was a muffin top. He cinched his belt tight around a growing waistline, creating an overflow roll of bulk that circled his body. This caused him to remove his sidearm when he worked in his pod so that the arm of his desk chair didn't drive the hard-edged weapon into his side. He usually placed the gun in the top drawer of his desk. Okay, we draw him out without his gun, Bosch said, and we brace him. But he always takes his gun when he leaves the office, Lourdes said. It'd be a violation if he didn't. We get him over to the old jail to come see me. That could work. We just need the reason. They were both silent as they thought about a way to draw Luzon across the street from the station without his gun. Soon they concocted a two-part plan, but it would involve the police chief's cooperation. This was not a deterrent, because they knew they could not carry out any confrontation with Luzon without alerting command staff. They finished their coffees and walked back to the station, going directly to the chief of police's office and asking for an audience. Chief Valdez was not happy with what Bosch and Lourdes told him, but agreed that an investigation had to be carried out. The chief was particularly pained, because 17 years before, when Luzon came into the department, Valdez had been his training officer. They had been close at one time. He knew several Sanfors, Valdez said. He grew up with them, and it worked in our favor. We would stop and talk to these guys, and we always picked up good intel we shot back to the gang team. Look, Chief, we're not accusing him of being a double agent, Bosch said. He could have been used or tricked, or he might not even be the source. That's what we have to talk about with him. But the bottom line is, he never put Mejia in the book, and Mejia took out our witness. I get it, Valdez said. It has to be done. What's your plan? It was simple. The chief would have his secretary call Luzon to his office to pick up some paperwork relating to a training day scheduled for the next month. It was likely that Luzon would not clip on his firearm just for a short jaunt down the hall from the detective bureau. While he was picking up the paperwork from the secretary, the chief would step out of his office to say hello. He would then ask Luzon to take a printed memo over to Bosch in the old jail. The direct route to the jail would not be through the detective bureau. The plan pivoted on the idea that Luzon would proceed directly to Bosch without going out of his way back to his desk to pick up his weapon. They also allowed for a quick abort if the chief saw that Luzon was armed, or if Luzon cut back to the detective bureau to retrieve his gun before leaving the station and crossing the street. "Now does he carry a backup?" Valdez asked. "If he does, it's not registered," Bosch said. "We checked the registry," Lourdes said. Department regulations allowed an officer to carry a boot gun or some other backup weapon, as long as it was on an approved list of firearms, and the officer notified command staff and entered the details in the weapons registry. "Did you ever know him to carry a throwdown?" Bosch asked. "No, never," Valdez said. "So do we do this?" Bella asked. "We do it," Valdez said. "But Bella, I want you over there with Harry, as backup." "Got it," she said. An hour later, they went forward with the plan. Lourdes confirmed that Luzon was at his desk and was not wearing his weapon before she sent Valdez the go-ahead text. The chief then told his secretary to summon Luzon, and when the detectives left the bureau, Lourdes confirmed that he had left his weapon behind. She then headed out the side door and crossed the street to the old jail. Bosch was sitting at his makeshift desk in the old drunk tank when Luzon walked in carrying a memo from the chief with the schedule for the upcoming training days. He put it down on the old door that Bosch used as a desktop. "That's from the chief," he said. "Asked me to drop it by." "Thanks," Bosch said. Luzon turned to go back. "Did you hear about Silmar last night?" Bosch asked. Luzon reversed himself and was facing Bosch again. "Silmar," he asked. "What about it?" "They got the guy who hit our witness," Bosch said. Luzon just looked at him, revealing nothing. "He took a shot in the gut himself," Bosch said, "so he's not doing too good. They're hoping to stabilize him and have him ready to talk in a day or two." "Good," Luzon said. "I'm going back to the bureau." He once more moved toward the cell's exit. "That doesn't worry you, Oscar?" Bosch asked. Luzon once again turned back and looked at Bosch. "What's that supposed to mean?" Luzon asked. "It was your buddy, the witch doctor, Carlos Mejia," Bosch said. "And I lied. He's already talking and he gave you up. Said you told him about Martin Perez." "That's bullshit." Lourdes stepped out of the next cell down and into the hallway that ran in front of the old cells. She took a position behind Luzon. He felt her presence and turned to see her. "What the fuck is this?" he said. Bosch stood up. "You know what it is?" he said. "This is your chance to get out in front of this. Tell us what happened, what you did, and maybe there's a way out for you."
"I didn't do anything. I told you. This is bullshit."
"You're playing it wrong, man. You're giving him the leverage. They'll lock in his story and come for you." Luzon seemed to freeze. His eyes went blank as he tried to figure out his next move. Bosch said nothing. Lourdes said nothing. They waited.
"All right, look," he finally said. "I made a mistake. You two weren't saying shit about what the search warrant at the garage was about. I thought maybe I could come up with something that would help. All I did was ask him what that place had to do with the Sanfors. That's it. He figured everything out from there."
"That story is what's bullshit," Bosch said. "How'd he find Perez in Alhambra?"
"I don't know, but it wasn't me. You're the one who got Perez killed. Don't look at me now."
"Nah, man, it was you. You told Mejia. And the thing is, he's going to give you up in a heartbeat as soon as they offer him a deal." Luzon stared at Bosch as he realized that Mejia wasn't talking yet, and that he had fallen for the oldest cop bluff in the book. He turned to Lourdes as if for help. Bosch was an outsider in the department, but Lourdes was not. He looked to her, but the cold set of her eyes showed he would get no sympathy from her.
"I want a lawyer," he said.
"You can call one as soon as you're booked," Bosch said. He came around the desk as Lourdes pulled her handcuffs off her belt. He put his hand on Luzon's shoulder and directed him toward the hallway where Lourdes was waiting. He walked him through. "Hands behind your back," he said. "You know the drill." Bosch gripped Luzon by the elbow and turned him to face away from Lourdes. At that moment, Lutzon brought his hands up and shoved Bosch into the cell's bars. He then rushed into the cell, and with both hands slid the door shut with a heavy metal clang. He quickly pulled the chain and padlock through the bars into the cell and locked the door. "Oscar, what are you doing?" Lourdes said. "There's nowhere to go." Bosch had lost his balance against the bars. He righted himself and reached into his pocket for his key ring. It had the padlock key on it. But the key ring wasn't there, and he looked through the bars and he could see it on his desk. He looked at Lutzon, who was pacing in the cell, a man looking for options where there weren't any. "Oscar, come on, settle down," Lourdes said. "Come out of there." "The key's on the desk, Oscar," Bosch said. "Unlock the door." Lutzon acted like he didn't hear them. He paced back and forth a few times, and then abruptly sat down on the end of the bench that ran almost the length of the cell. He bent over, put his elbows on his knees, and dropped his face into his hands. Bosch leaned over to Lourdes and cupped his hands around her ear. "Go out into the yard and get a bolt cutter," he whispered. Lourdes immediately headed down the corridor in front of the cells to the door that led to the public works yard. That left Bosch looking through the bars at Lutzon. "Oscar, come on," he said. "Open the door. We can work this out." Lutzon was silent, face in his hands. "Oscar," Bosch said, "talk to me. You want me to get the chief in here? I know you two go way back. You want to talk to him?" "Nothing." And then without a word, Lutzon dropped his hands and stood. He reached to his neck and started to pull off his tie. He then climbed up onto the bench and reached up to the cell's ceiling, where there was a metal grate over an air vent. He pushed the skinny end of his tie into the grate and worked it back out of the next opening. "Oscar, come on, don't do this," Bosch said. "Oscar!" Lutzon knotted the two ends of the tie together and then twisted the loop into a figure eight. He stood on his toes to get his head through the makeshift noose, and then without hesitation, stepped off the end of the bench. Chapter 24 Bosch and Lourdes waited in the hallway. Only the chief of police and family members were allowed back into the critical care unit. For the most part, they sat quietly and drank coffee from paper cups out of a machine. After 2 hours, Chief Valdez emerged with the news. "They say he only went a couple minutes without oxygen to the brain, so he should be all right," he said. "It's a waiting game on that. The bigger concern is the skull fracture from when he hit the ground when the grate gave way." Bosch had witnessed and heard the impact when Lutzon's swinging body brought the iron grate down and the back of his head hit the end of the bench, like a high diver hitting the board after a flip. "Is he conscious?" Lourdes asked. "He was, but then they went into surgery," Valdez said. "They say he's got a subdural hematoma and that they had to evacuate it, which means they drilled a fucking hole in his skull to let the blood and pressure out." "Shit," Lourdes said. "Anyway, I want a full report on what happened in that cell and everything that led up to it," Valdez said. "How did it go so far sideways, Harry?" Bosch tried to compose an answer. "He took me by surprise," he finally said. "He must have known that that was the way some drunks did it back in the day." "Everybody knows that," Valdez said. "You should have been prepared for it." Bosch nodded. He knew Valdez was right. "It's on me," Bosch said. "But are we going to charge him? I have the whole thing on my phone. He tipped Mejia. He put it in terms of a mistake, but he's responsible." "I'm not worried about that right now," Valdez said. "We'll look at that later." Bosch could see that the chief was having trouble concealing his anger about the whole thing. "Bella, why don't you go back to the station and start in on the paper," Valdez said. "Roger that," Lourdes said. Valdez stood there and was awkwardly silent as he waited for Lourdes to leave. "See you guys back there," she said. Valdez watched her go down the hall toward the elevator alcove. When he judged she was far enough away, he spoke. "Harry, we need to talk." "I know. I'm going to ask the sheriff's department to come in and take a look at this and how it was handled. I think an outside review would be a good thing." "I can save you the trouble, Chief. I fucked up. I know it. You know, as a reserve, you don't have the same protections the full-timers do." "I know. Are you firing me?" "I think you should go home and let the sheriff's department take a look at this." "I'm suspended, then." "Whatever. Just go home, Harry, and take a break. When and if the time is right, you'll be back. When and if. Okay, Chief. I'll do that. I'll send Lourdes the audio from the cell. That would be good, yeah. Bosch turned and walked away, heading down the hallway in the direction Lourdes had gone. He knew there was a very low chance that he would be back working for San Fernando after this. He thought about going by the city complex, gathering a few files and personal things from his office in the old jail, but then decided against it. He just drove home. He returned to a quiet house. He checked the porch first, but there was no sign of Elizabeth. He then went down the hallway to her room and found the door open. The bed had been made, and there were clean folded towels on the bureau. He checked the closet. There were no clothes on the hangers, and no sign of the suitcase she had used. She was gone. Bosch pulled his phone and called the number of the cell phone he had given her. After a few seconds, he heard its ring inside the house and found the phone left with a note on the dining room table. The note was brief. "Harry, you are a good man. Thank you for everything. I'm glad I got to know you. Elizabeth." A wave of emotion immediately went through him. He had to admit there was at first relief. Elizabeth had been right, that her staying with him was damaging his relationship with his daughter. There was also the relief from the pressures of living with an addict, of not knowing when she might stumble or what would cause it. But then that feeling was crowded out by concern. What did Elizabeth's leaving mean? Was she going home to Modesto? Or was she going back to the addiction she had worked for months to leave behind? She had not had a single relapse in that time, and Bosch had thought she was getting stronger every day. Bosch had to consider that she had found clarity of mind and the access it gave her to guilt over her daughter's death too difficult to continue to live with. Bosch opened the sliding door and walked out onto the back deck of the house. He looked down on the freeway and the wide expanse of the city beyond it to the mountains that rimmed the valley. Elizabeth could be out there somewhere. He pulled his phone and ducked back in and away from the freeway hiss to make a call to Cisco Wojciechowski. They had not spoken in at least 2 months, since the last time Cisco had checked in on Elizabeth's progress. He was a private investigator who worked for Mickey Haller, a defense attorney who was also Bosch's half-brother. That had put him into Bosch's orbit, and he had been instrumental in getting Elizabeth Clayton straight. Even more than Bosch, Wojciechowski was responsible for Elizabeth's recovery. He had seen her through the immediate withdrawal from the grip of oxycodone. Formerly addicted himself, he had walked and talked her through it, monitored her every minute at first, then by hour, and then by day. She had followed that detox with a one-month stint in a more traditional rehab center. After she moved into the room offered by Bosch, Cisco was her weekly monitor. The check-ins didn't start to drop off until Elizabeth hit the 3-month mark without a relapse. Now Bosch told him that she was gone without much notice or any indication of where she was going. "Is she answering her phone?" Cisco asked. "She left it here," Bosch said. "That's not good. She doesn't want to be tracked." "What I was thinking." They were both silent for a while. "If we take the worst-case scenario, she's decided to go back to the life," Bosch said. "The question is, where would she go?" "Does she have any money?" Cisco asked. Bosch had to think about that. In the last 2 months, Elizabeth had gotten bored when Bosch went to work at the SFPD. Bosch let her use his credit card to install an Uber account on her phone. She had asked to take over the duties of shopping for food and household products. He had given her cash for that. Between the credit card number and the possibility that she could have put aside small amounts from the grocery money, he had to assume that she had the wherewithal to get back to Modesto, or to buy her way back into addiction. "Let's say she does," Bosch said. "Where would she go?" "Addicts are creatures of habit," Cisco said. "She'd go back to where she scored before." Bosch thought about the place he had rescued Elizabeth from the previous year, a clinic that was little more than a pill mill with examination rooms crowded with the items stolen and offered in trade by addicts. When he found her, Elizabeth had only herself to trade. The place I took her from, this so-called clinic in Van Nuys, has got to be closed by now, he said. My old partner from Hollywood Detectives is now with the state medical board. He was there and saw that place. He was going to shut them down. You sure? Sisko asked. Sometimes these doctors get a slap on the wrist and just open up across the street. Bosch recalled Jerry Edgar talking about how difficult it was to put charlatan doctors and pill mills out of business permanently. Let me call you back, he said. Without waiting for a reply, he disconnected and went to his contact screen. He called his former partner, and Edgar picked up right away.
Harry Bosch, he said. The man who said he would stay in touch but waited a lot of months to actually do it.
Sorry, Jerry, I've been kind of busy, Bosch said. I've got a question for you, though. Remember that clinic where we found Elizabeth Clayton last year?
Yeah, Sherman Way.
You said you were going to close that down. Did that happen?
Wait a minute. I said I was going to try to close it down. It's not an easy thing to do, Harry. I told you about how.
Yeah, I know, a lot of red tape. So you're telling me that 7 months later that place is still operating?
I opened a file, did the work, and submitted it. The license to practice is under what we call administrative review. I'm waiting on the board to act on it.
So in the meantime, that guy we saw in there, that guy masquerading as a doctor, is still in there writing scripts?
I haven't checked, but that's probably the case.
Thanks, Jerry. That's all I needed. I gotta go.
Harry?
Bosch disconnected. Before calling Sisko back, he pulled his wallet and dug out the credit card he had given to Elizabeth to set up her Uber account. He called the phone number on the back and asked the service specialist to read him a list of his most recent charges. Other than an Uber charge from that morning, all the purchases had been his own. Bosch grabbed the phone Elizabeth had left behind on the dining room table. He opened the Uber app and was greeted with a template for rating the driver who had picked Elizabeth up that morning. Bosch gave him 5 stars, then tapped the My Trips link and was taken to a map that showed the morning's ride and the address of the destination. Elizabeth had obviously called for the Uber, then left the phone behind when the car arrived. The destination was the Greyhound bus terminal in North Hollywood. It would seem that Elizabeth had left the city on a Greyhound bus, but Bosch was familiar with the area, having worked cases over the years that took him to the bus terminal and its surroundings, and he knew the neighborhood had a high transient population, many of whom were drug addicts, and had several clinics and mom-and-pop pharmacies that catered to them. Bosch called Wojciechowski back. The place I pulled her out of is still in business, he said, but I just traced an Uber she took this morning to the bus station in North Hollywood. She could be back in Modesto by now, or...
Or what? Sisko prompted.
You talked about addicts returning to the places they know. The area around the bus terminal is pretty gritty. Lots of clinics, lots of pharmacies, lots of addicts. There's a park there next to the 170 where they hang. There was a moment of silence before Sisko responded. I'll meet you there, he said.
Ballard. Chapter 25. After spending the day with Aaron Hayes and Lola, Ballard headed downtown for a pre-shift dinner with Heather Rourke, the helicopter spotter, at the Denny's outside the entrance to Piper Tech, on whose roof the LAPD air unit was located. It had become a familiar routine for Ballard and Rourke to meet once or twice a month before their respective shifts. A connection had grown between them. They both worked graveyard, and more often than not, Rourke was Ballard's partner in the sky, running as both lookout and backup. Their first meal together had been offered by Ballard as a thank you, after Rourke had spotted a hooded man waiting in ambush for Ballard when she responded to a burglary call. The suspect turned out to have been previously arrested by Ballard for an attempted rape. He was out on bail, awaiting trial, and had made the phony burglary call, hoping that it would be Ballard who responded. Rourke had picked up a heat signature on the air unit's camera screen and radioed a warning down to Ballard. The hooded man was arrested after a short foot chase. Rourke was able to direct Ballard back to a duffel bag the man had thrown while running. It contained a complete rape package, duct tape, handcuffs, and snap ties. After this latest arrest, The man was deemed a danger to the community and denied bail. When Ballard and Rourke got together, they mostly gossiped about the department. Ballard had early on told Rourke about her fall from grace at Robbery Homicide Division, but in subsequent meetings, she listened more than she talked because she largely worked alone and mostly encountered the same group of officers on the Hollywood Late Show. It was a closed environment that produced little in the way of new department intel from dinner to dinner. Rourke, on the other hand, was part of a large unit that supported 18 helicopters, the largest police air force in the country. Veteran officers gravitated to the unit because the hours were steady and it included the hazard bump on the salary scale. She heard a lot in the break room from officers with connections all over the department and was happy to keep Ballard up to speed. It was a sisterhood of two. Ballard always ordered breakfast there because it seemed like a meal that was impossible to mess up. Denny's was their choice because it was more convenient to Rourke and was part of Ballard's ongoing thank you for the warning about the hooded man. Also, both women were fans of the movie Drive, and it was at this location that the film's female lead worked as a waitress. Now Ballard told Rourke about her involvement in the investigation of the 9-year-old murder of Daisy Clayton and her meeting Harry Bosch. Rourke had never met him or heard of him. "It's weird," Ballard said. "I like working with him and think I can learn a few things. But at the end of the day, I don't think I can trust him. It's like he's not telling me everything he knows." "You gotta be careful of those guys," Rourke said. "On the job and off." Rourke was in her green flight suit, which went well with her red-brown hair, kept short like most of the other female coppers Ballard knew. She was petite and no more than 100 pounds, which must have been a plus in an air unit where weight was a factor in lift and fuel consumption. Rourke was more interested in hearing about Ballard's other cases and the groundside story of the incidents she had been involved in from above. So Ballard told her about the dead woman whose cat ate her face and the young peeping toms on the roof of the strip bar. When it was time to go, Ballard picked up the check, and Rourke said the next one was hers. "Call if you need me," Rourke said, her usual goodbye. "Fly like an eagle," Ballard answered with hers. Once in her van, Ballard's goodbye to Rourke reminded her of the man called Eagle, who had gotten baptized on the same night as Daisy Clayton. She had forgotten to follow up on him and planned to do it as soon as she returned to Hollywood Station and could access the moniker files in the department's database. She checked her phone to see if she had gotten a call from Bosch during dinner. There were no messages, and she wondered if he would turn up tonight. She headed up the 101 to the Sunset exit and got to Hollywood Station 2 hours before the start of her shift. She had wanted to get there before PM Watch went off duty. She needed to talk to Lieutenant Gabriel Mason, who worked PM Watch and who had been a sergeant 9 years ago and assigned as Hollywood Division liaison to the department's GRASP program. Since Hollywood was busiest during PM Watch, which roughly ran from 3 p.m. to midnight, there were 2 lieutenants assigned to supervise the shift. Mason was one of the two, and Hannah Chavez was the other. Ballard did not know Mason that well, because her limited experience with PM Watch had been with Chavez. She decided that the straight-on approach would be best. She found him in the break room, with deployment calendars spread out on a table. He was a bookish-looking administrator with glasses and black hair parted sharply on the left side. His uniform looked crisp and new. "Lieutenant," Ballard said. He looked up, annoyed with the interruption, but then his scowl disappeared when he saw Ballard. "Ballard, you're in early," he said. "Thanks for responding." Ballard shook her head. "I don't understand," she said. "You wanted to see me?" "Yeah, I put a message in your box," Mason said. "You get it?" "No, but what's up? I was actually going to ask you something." "I need you to do a welfare check." "During graveyard?" "I know it's unusual, but there's something hinky going on with this one. comes from the 10th floor. A missing guy, hasn't responded to phone calls or social media in a week. We've gone by a few times today, and his roommate says he's out every time. Not much we can do. But I figure if you knock on the door in the middle of the night, the guy's going to be home or not. And if not, then we go to the next step. The reference to the 10th floor meant the OCP, Office of the Chief of Police, on the 10th floor of the police administration building. So who's the guy? Ballard asked. I Googled him, Mason said. Looks like his father's friends with the mayor. A high-dollar donor, so we can't let it drop. If he's still not home tonight, send a report to Captain Whittle, and he'll report to the OCP about it. And we'll be done with it or not. Okay. You have the name and address? It's all in your box, and I'll put it on the activity report for your lieutenant. Got it. Now, you wanted to see me about something? He pointed to the chair across the table from him, and Ballard sat down. I'm working a cold case from 09, she said. Teenage runaway selling it on the streets was found dumped in an alley off Cahuenga. Her name was Daisy Clayton. Mason thought for a moment, and then shook his head. Not ringing any bells, he said. I wasn't expecting it to, Ballard said. But I asked around. Back then, you were the division liaison for the GRASP program. Jesus, don't remind me. What a nightmare that was. Well, I know the department dumped the program when the new chief came in, but what I'm wondering about is what happened to all the Hollywood crime data. What? Why? I'm trying to get a handle on this girl's murder, and I thought it would be good if I could get a look at everything that was happening in the division that night or that week. As you can tell, we don't have a lot, so I'm grasping at straws a bit. Who's we? Just a figure of speech. So, do you know where all the data went when the GRASP program ended? Yeah, it went down the digital toilet. It was purged when the new administration wanted to go another way. Ballard frowned and nodded. It was a dead end. Officially, at least, Mason said. Ballard looked at him. What was he saying? I was the guy who had to collate and send all the data downtown. There was a guy we called the GRASP Guru. He wasn't a sworn officer. He was this computer genius from USC who came up with the whole thing and sold it to the chief. All the data went to him, and he did all the modeling. Ballard started to get excited. She knew that guys like the one Mason was describing were proprietary about their work and accomplishments. The order may have come down to end the program and spike the data, but there was a chance the civilian, whose baby it was, had kept records of the program. Do you remember his name? She asked. Yeah, I should. I worked with him every day for 2 years, Mason said. Professor Scott Calder. Don't know if he's still there, but at the time he was on sabbatical from the computer science school. Thanks, LT. I'll find him. Hope it helps. Don't forget about that welfare check. I'm going to my box now. Ballard got up, but then sat back down and looked at Mason. She was going to risk turning what could be the start of a solid relationship with a supervisor into something fraught. Something else? Mason asked. Yes, LT, Ballard began. Last night I was working during PMs and busted a guy on a burglary. I was working solo when I called for backup. It never came. The guy made a move on me, and I put him down, but he wouldn't have had the chance if I'd had the backup. I was the one who took your call when you used the private line to ask where the troops were. I thought so. Did you find out what happened? I'm sorry, I didn't. I got caught up in some stuff. All I know was there was no call on the board. There must have been a fuck-up between the comm center and the watch office. We never were copied. I heard no backup call go out. Ballard looked at him for a long moment. So you're saying the problem wasn't at Hollywood Station. It was at the comm center. near as I can tell. Mason sat silently. He did not offer to follow up. He wasn't going to rock any boats. It was clear that it was Ballard's decision whether to pursue it. Okay. Thanks, Lieutenant, she said. Ballard got up and left the room. Chapter 26. Ballard used her password to enter the department database, and then began a search of the man who signed Eagle to his photo at the Moonlight Mission. The database contained a moniker file, which carried thousands of nicknames and aliases amassed from crime reports, arrest records, and field interviews. Eagle turned out to be a popular moniker. She got 241 initial hits. She was then able to chop this down to 68 by limiting her search to white males 30-plus years old. She had the 9-year-old photo she had borrowed from the mission to guide her. The man depicted looked to be mid to late 20s, and that would put him over 30 now. She refined the search further by eliminating possibles who were over 40. She was left with 16 names and set to work pulling up reports and photos of the men. She quickly eliminated men who looked nothing like the man in the photo provided by John the Baptist. She hit pay dirt with the 11th man she looked at. His name was Dennis Eagleton, and he was 37 years old. Mugshots from multiple arrests between 2008 and 2013 matched the face of the man in the photo from the mission. She pulled up and started printing all reports in the database regarding Eagleton. He had a record of numerous arrests for drugs and loitering, and only one incident of violence, an aggravated assault charge in 2010 that was knocked down to a simple battery. Ballard even found a digitized field interview report written by Tim Farmer in 2014, his last full year on the job. The summary section included Farmer's unique take on the Hollywood streets and this particular denizen. This is not the first nor the last time we will cross paths with Eagle. A deep, cancerous river of hate and violence courses through his veins. I can feel it, see it. He waits. He hates. He blames the world for its betrayal of all hope. I fear for us. Ballard read Farmer's take twice. It was written 5 years after Daisy Clayton's murder. Could the pulsing, waiting violence that Farmer saw in Eagleton have already been let loose in 2009? Rather than seeing the future, had Farmer also seen the past? Ballard spent the next half hour trying to locate Eagleton, but she found nothing. No driver's license, no recent arrests. The last known record of him had been the FI card Farmer had filled out. He had stopped Eagleton and questioned him when he was seen loitering around the metro entrance on Hollywood Boulevard near Vine. In the blank marked occupation, Farmer had written panhandler. There were now no indications as to whether Eagleton was alive or dead, only that he had gone completely off the electronic grid. It was now after midnight and time to conduct the welfare check Lieutenant Mason had assigned Ballard. She used a Bolo template to put together a wanted for questioning sheet on Eagleton that would be distributed at all roll calls. After including screen grabs of his 3 most recent mugshots, she sent the package to the printer and signed off the computer. She was ready to go. Her first stop was the watch office to drop off the Bolo sheet with Lieutenant Monroe and to tell him she was leaving the station to handle the welfare check. Monroe said the officers assigned to patrol in the neighborhood in question were finishing up a minor call, but he would send them to her location as soon as they were clear. The missing man was named Jacob Cady. His home was in a 4-story condominium building on Willoughby, just a block from the West Hollywood border. Ballard pulled over against a red curb and looked around for her backup. She saw nothing and used her rover to check with Monroe, who said the patrol unit had not cleared their call. Ballard decided to give it 10 minutes before she went in alone. She pulled her phone and checked her texts. There had been no response from Bosch to her message about John the Baptist, and none to a text she had sent earlier to Aaron Hayes to check on his well-being. She didn't think she should text him again, for fear she might wake him up. She checked her email next, and saw that the blind email she had sent to Scott Calder with the standard USC address had already been answered. She opened it to find that she had reached the correct Calder, and that he would be happy to meet early the next morning in his office to discuss the LAPD's defunct GRASP program. He gave his office location in the Viterbi building on McClintock Avenue, and said he had an opening in his schedule at 8 a.m. After 10 minutes, there was still no sign of a backup unit. Ballard decided to check out Jacob Cady's online profile. In just a few minutes, she was able to determine that he was the 29-year-old son of a City Hall player of the same name who held several city maintenance contracts. The son apparently didn't want any part of the father's business and described himself on Facebook as a party planner. The photos on Facebook revealed a jet-set lifestyle for the young Cady. It looked like he favored Mexican resorts and the company of men. He was tan and trim with feathered blonde hair. He liked form-fitting clothing and Tito's vodka. 20 minutes after arrival, Ballard got out with her Rover and headed toward the entrance to the condo building. She radioed the watch office and reported that she was going in solo. The documents left in her mailbox by Lieutenant Mason said that Cady owned the two-bedroom condo and rented space in it to a roommate named Talisman Prada. On the two prior welfare checks by patrol officers, Prada had answered the door and said that Cady had met a man in a bar two nights before and had gone home with him. But this did not explain why Cady was no longer answering texts, email, or phone calls, or why his car was parked in a reserved spot in the condominium's underground garage. Ballard pressed the buzzer at the gate three separate times before a sleepy voice answered. "Mr. Cady?"
"No, he's not here."
The connection was ended. Ballard buzzed again.
"What?"
"Mr. Prada?"
"Who's this?"
"The police. Will you open the gate?"
"I told you, Jacob is not here. He woke me up."
"Again, Mr. Prada, this is the police. Open the gate." There was a long beat of silence before the gate buzzed, and Ballard pulled it open. She checked the street for the backup unit and saw nothing. She looked around the entry area. There was a rack of mailboxes with a shelf below it where some unclaimed newspapers were left. Ballard grabbed one and used it to prop open the gate for the backup officers, if they ever arrived. She entered and, while waiting for the elevator, used the Rover to